see, must have certain general idea of the setting of the Gita. See, Gita happens to be incorporated in the great epic Mahabharata. You see, the story of Indian epic story. Two epics are there, Mahabharata and Ramayana. Gita happens to be an episode in the great epic. It is not a separate composition, though it may be, perhaps it was created separately, written separately, and then put into the Gita. One doesn't know. Historically, these things are not clear. In Indian cultural history, they are very lax about historical sense, and so it is not sure whether Gita was originally a part of the epic, or in the epic that was current, Gita was put in afterwards by somebody who thought that was the best place to put Gita in, you see. But Gita happens now to be a part of the Mahabharata, but it has acquired such an independent importance that many people in India have forgotten it, that it belongs to the Mahabharata or it's a part of the Mahabharata. It has become an independent book of reference. It is a scripture, so to say. It is a very holy book in the sense that people refer to it almost in the same way as they would refer to any ancient text, Ved or Upanishad, you see. But it has acquired that place by its prominence in the life and by the studies that have been given to it during hundreds of years. And it has a vast literature about it. Gita is written over, I think, by people in India, outside, and so on. All kinds of people have written many things about the Gita. Now, this is the third synthesis of Indian culture, this Gita. First synthesis of Indian culture is the Veda, you see, where you find the cultural soul of India expressing itself first time in an integral and organic synthetic way, putting all the hymns of the pre-Vedic period into the form of the Veda. The Veda, the historicity of the Veda is not known. They are the first book, that is true. First book of humanity or mankind is the Veda. That is the first book. Before that, there is no other book that was written, you see. And in the organization of this book, it appears that perhaps there are many hymns current before, and it is at the time of Veda that they seem to have put these 10,500 or 10,540 rics hymns together. They have put it together, you see, dividing it into 10 parts and so on. But that is Vedic study. Now, that is the first synthesis of Indian spirit in which the experience of the early spheres of the Indian culture is embodied in a symbolic language. After 1,000 or 1,500 years comes another time when the Upanishads were organized and found expression as the highest cultural expression of the Indian spirit. Upanishads follow the Vedic times, but they are written about 1,000 or 1,200 to 1,500 years after the Veda. Therefore, the language undergoes a change, but the subject matter remains the same, the search for the truth and the method of attaining the truth. That is the main subject of both these, you see. How to attain the highest truth and the goal of life, being immortality or attainment of truth, how to rise to it, that is the problem, both in the Veda as well as in the Upanishads. Upanishads speak in a language which is more easily understandable because it is nearer the classical language of Sanskrit. Gita, after about 1,000 years again, after 1,000 or perhaps 1,200 years after the Upanishad, gives you another synthesis of Indian spirit. In between, means from the Upanishadic time to the Gita time, much had taken place, a far great advance has taken place in the field of yoga, philosophy and so on, search for the truth. And Gita again puts the whole thing together in a kind of synthesis, whether consciously or unconsciously, but Gita is the third synthesis of Indian spirit. After that, if you go about 1,000 years afterwards, you find the epics, the Mahabharata and the Ramayana, in which the Gita is placed, you see. The epics are the first, and the Puranas, means the mythologies, follow afterwards. The Puranas, the epics are contemporaneous almost with the Gita, or a little later, and the mythological writings come very near the 15th, 14th, 13th century. So they are very near the modern times, you see. Now these four periods represent the big efforts of Indian spirit to make a synthesis and make it popular among the people. In the age of the mythology, the whole message of the Indian culture went to the masses. Gita represents the third period of Indian synthesis. That's what I want to tell you this evening. That is the third period, that's one. And Buddhistic period after the Gita, of course, either it was contemporaneous or just after the Gita, Buddha's. And you see the period that gives rise to Jainism and Buddhism, these two also, well, occur just at the time of the Gita simultaneously or little after. Now, Gita represents a synthesis of, you see, by the time that Gita was written, Sankhya was already there, Sankhya philosophy, Sankhya in which Purusha and Prakriti, the subjective self and the objective nature, the active nature, that is the main philosophical doctrine, and then it explains all the material elements by enumerating earth and water and fire and sky and you see electricity and so on. Like that it explains the material world and explains the connection of a subjective consciousness with this material world by positing two elements which are permanent, Purusha and Prakriti. The two are eternal and separate, according to Sankhya. It is Vedanta that came and brought them together, you see. Sankhya had a dichotomy, two eternal elements permanently separate from one another, the Purusha consciousness, the watching self, and the Prakriti. And in the Prakriti, intellect, emotion, will, nervous system, physical system, earth, water, sky, ether, fire, all in one. That is inconscient nature. Right up to intellect, it is all inconscient. Only the cognizing consciousness gives it the light of consciousness. That is how the Sankhyas look upon the world. Well, Sankhya was one system that was current at the time of the Gita. Then there was this system of Raja Yoga, system of Jnana Yoga, system of Bhakti Yoga, system of Karma Yoga. So Gita takes up these and, well, puts them into a synthesis, you see. Gita takes up all the intermediate strands that happened between Upanishadic time and the Gita time and then puts them together into a kind of integration or a synthetic, you know, representation of cultural strand, making up a metaphysical whole. That is what Gita achieves, you see. And that is why perhaps it is satisfying to most people even up to now, because it is not one-sided or it is not as if sectarian in its outlook, it is not, you know, weighed down by partiality for one against the other or something like that. It's very Catholic in spirit and very, very wide and in the way in which it looks at metaphysical or yogic or philosophical problems. It is always ready to accommodate and give each thing its proper place. Now, Gita gives you for the first time many things which, you see, were not so well developed and prominently brought forward by the Upanishads. The Upanishad brought forward certain aspects which were not clearly brought forward by the Veda. The Veda spoke a language which was perfectly, completely different from the language of the Upanishads. And it was symbols. And Sanskrit was also a language not yet fully formed at the time of the Veda. Therefore, the grammar is different. In the Upanishads, the grammar is definite and the terminology becomes different. In Gita's time, again, you find certain new ideas which Upanishads have perhaps thought of or spoken of lightly, like a suggestion or hinted at it. But in the Gita, it finds a prominent place, and then you find that Gita has added something to the cultural growth of the ideal of, Indian spirituality. But more than its metaphysics, which we'll come to, first and most attractive part of the Gita is that it is not a book of philosophy pure. These are its secondary advantages, which you get a synthesis and all that. Metaphysical truths which were not in the Upanishads are brought forward. But Gita's greatest advantage is that it's not a philosophical book. It is not as if somebody was sitting down and asking, what is the soul, who created the world, how the world was made, what is the relation between man and world, or God and world and man, and so on. No. It's a book which addresses itself to a life situation. Arjuna is on the battlefield. The situation in which Gita opens is that Arjuna, one of the commanders of the Pandava army, is on the battlefield of Kurukshetra where they are going to fight. The fight was with regard to division of the empire. Do you know that story? Most of you must know it perhaps. You see, there were two cousins, you see, two groups of cousins rather. Means, and they were, they disagreed about the partition of the empire. So one part, sons of Dhritarashtra, the Kauravas, well, claimed that they had a greater right. And so they first gave a portion to the Pandavas and then called the Pandavas to gambling, you see. And in the gambling, the Pandavas lost whatever portion they got as their share. And then the condition was that if they lose the game, well, they will go out in the forest for 12 years. And 13th year they must remain incognito. 12 years in forest and 13th year they must not be found. They must be completely underground, so to say. If they are discovered, then again 12 years more they will have to go. And then after 12 years their portion will be restored to them. You see, if they are not found. This was the understanding. I mean, roughly the idea was like that. That is the setting in the Mahabharata, you see. Now, Gita starts with the situation where the two armies are on the battlefield. The whole thing has finished, the 12 years have passed, 13th year they were hiding and they were not detected. Kaurava said, we have detected you. Pandava said, you have not detected us. And there was a quarrel on that point. And so they refused to give any portion. The Kauravas refused to give anything. He said, no, they can't be given because you have been found out. This was the point of contention. That is the original story in the epic. Now, Gita starts on the point where the two armies are, therefore, Krishna went and tried to persuade the two parties to come to terms, to tell the Kauravas to give something to the people. After all, he said, they are your cousins. And your father was the emperor, your father was the blind man, and their father was actually in charge of the kingdom, so you must give them something. But they didn't yield. So there was decision of fight. And Gita opens on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. So Gita is not written really in a room. Gita is spoken on the battlefield. That is the context. You see, the writer of the Gita doesn't say, I write the Gita. He says, you see, here are two armies standing together, standing against one another. And here is Arjuna asking Krishna the question, who are those people who are standing? And then, of course, somebody describes, Krishna describes. And then Arjuna at once is faced with a psychological crisis. So Gita addresses itself to a life situation. Gita is not written for philosophy, it is written when one finds it difficult to solve a problem in life. You see, the problem was to Arjuna whether it is good to kill his own cousins for the share of a kingdom. Even though they were right, their fight was righteous in the sense that their cause was just. Now for a just cause, till now he had fought hundreds of battles. There was no question in his mind about fighting. When he was fighting on the side of the right, well, he never thought that he was always on the side of the divine. And therefore he was performing the duty of a warrior, you see, kshatriya as they say, the fighter. His duty is to fight for the right cause, protect the old, women and children, and fight against any injustice that is done anywhere. That is a duty. And that he must do impersonally. Well, he was doing it. So, till now, it is not that he was fighting for the first time, but the first psychological crisis came to him for the first time when he saw that now he has to kill his own cousins. If he is to take his kingdom, he must kill his own cousins. So, there is a crisis in the psychological state of Arjuna, whether it is correct for a fighter, even though his cause be just, to kill his own cousins, to destroy his own family. Well, that is the problem, you see. That is the Gita's background. And therefore Gita is very much, you know, relevant to the modern mind also, because the modern mind is practical and wants to apply highest truth to life, is it not? Well, Gita eminently supplies that need. It shows how to come to a decision when two values are at variance, or when there is a conflict between two values that you have been thinking of as equal, and how to come to the decision. You see, that is the Gita's one great advantage. Now, the second point about Gita is that Gita is one of the three books that have been regarded as very prominent in the Indian cultural history. That is to say, a man is called an acharya means a great, you know, like Pope, you know, pontific, his great spiritual leader, if he can consistently explain the Brahma Sutra, the Upanishad and the Gita. The three must be consistently explained for somebody to be called the leader of religious movement or a great religious, you know, leader. Just as you take, if you take the Old and the New Testament, suppose, and somebody is able to give a consistent explanation, then he will be considered very high in religious circle. Supposing that was the idea, well, the similar is the position of Brahma Sutra, Upanishad and the Gita in Indian culture, you see. Therefore, all eminent, you know, philosophers have written on the Gita, on the Upanishad and on the Brahma Sutra. They will always attempt to write because consistently apply their philosophy to that, you see. Your Gita being one of the three has been also well studied and has occupied a very high place in the religious, you know, estimation of Indian people. Now, in some respects Gita is a synthesis, as I told you, but in another respect it is a great progress forward, and in some respects it's a great revolutionary movement. Gita is a revolution also. Gita is a progress on what the Upanishad had done. And it is revolutionary about so many ideas that must have been current at the time when Gita was written. So that way Gita is attractive to the modern mind in many ways. First being practical, secondly being a synthesis and a wider outlook and tolerant way of arranging things and values. And third is pulling the thread of cultural life of India to a, you know, greater extent, I mean taking it more progressively forward beyond the Upanishadic range. And thirdly, that it has many revolutionary ideas in it, you see. It is not merely conformation or to tradition. Gita is very untraditional, though people have tried to make it into tradition. Even if the oldest man you find, most orthodox man in Benares or Haridwar, will swear by the Gita, and he might be breaking the teaching of the Gita every step, you see. But Gita has acquired that place. Now, Gita is very revolutionary in its, some of its conceptions. Well, we will try to see some of these conceptions. What are the new metaphysical positions of the Gita? Well, let me take up the development as I made at one point, I think. Now, detail will go a little after, perhaps. No? I really don't know what it is. I remember a tribute paid by one of the vice chancellors in Andhra University to Sri Aurobindo. I began with that in Banaras University when I gave the lecture on the Gita. It was Mr. C. R. Reddy, the Vice Chancellor of Andhra University, in the 30s of the last this century. See, in all humility of devotion, I hail Sri Aurobindo as the sole sufficient genius of the age. He is more than hero of the nation. He is among the saviors of humanity who belong to all ages, all nations, the Sanatanas or the Eternals who leaven our existence with their eternal presence, whether we are aware of it or not. He came to Pondicherry, this Sri Aurobindo, and was very much impressed. And I think it is the Andhra University that for the first time gave a merit prize to Sri Aurobindo for original contribution to world thought. After that, they stopped that prize because they thought that nobody would be able to deserve that prize which was once given to Sri Aurobindo. After that, they discontinued the prize. It was given another name and was turned over to a different subject matter, you see. Well, this I said this, it was because it was 4th of December at the time when I spoke at Benares. And also I refer to it now in one sense because he has written a great commentary, Essays on the Gita, on the Gita. You see, which is directly does not deal with the text, but which interprets the text, almost entitling him to become an acharya of Indian you know, religious life, because he has written on the Veda, he has written on the Upanishad, and he has written on the Gita. So the three main books of Indian scriptures, I mean three Indian scriptures having been commented upon by him consistently, well, he also is entitled to be an acharya in the old classical sense of the term, though he didn't care to be an acharya. And I don't think the orthodox people would accept it either. The Gita differs from all the scriptures of the world in that it is not a book of philosophy, just as I told you now, seeking for setting forth an explanation of the cosmos. Neither it is a book of revealed religion. Somebody saying that I give you the knowledge of God, come on. It's not written in that way. Yes. It's a book that addresses itself to a life situation. Yes, that's what they say almost, isn't it? Yes. It's not written in the cell of the philosopher or in the forest groves to answer the why and wherefore of the world and life. It answers the question, how to act in life in a critical situation created by conflicting values. In this regard, the Gita agrees perfectly with Sri Aurobindo's vision of the reality, that Sri Aurobindo's vision of the reality also connects the divine with life. And Gita addresses the whole question to relevancy of life and highest values of life. In fact, Gita brings in the question whether God has anything to do with life and action. And then there is a very large ground of agreement between Sri Aurobindo and the Gita's position, 90% almost, or 99%, you see. And, for he insists that life, as Sri Aurobindo also insists, and therefore all actions should be molded by the divine dwelling in the heart of man. He wants human life to become life divine. Gita tells us that the value of action depends upon, not upon its outer form, but on psychological basis from which it proceeds. This is one great fundamental idea of the Gita. It points a practical to a practical path to reach the basis, the true source of all action. In this respect, Gita is a value-centric book. It shows that normally man acts under the pressure of desire, emotions, greed, ambition, in short, on the basis of his ego. And this is not the right basis. That's what Gita points out. This is not the right basis. It is, or it should be, accepted as only a temporary basis. The one on which one is acting now is not a permanent and fixed law of nature, but a basis which one will temporarily accept, which serves some preliminary purpose of growth of man towards the light. You cannot often begin with the higher consciousness and act from there. So you admit and accept the basis of ego as a temporary measure for a purpose of growth toward the light. The right basis of action, the Gita says, is not even social morality or ethical idealism. The true source of action is the divine will in the individual, discoverable by him. That is the true source. Gita teaches that life and action are not to be renounced, but their ignorant and egoistic basis has to be rejected. And it has to be changed into the true basis, not only rejection, but a changing of the basis of action altogether, you see. It declares that the divine will is actively at work and can and does intervene in the critical life situation in the case of an individual and also in the case of the collectivity. When the individual gives up his egoistic initiation of action, then an impersonal and even a divine will can be discovered and obeyed. This great truth is crucial because it has a direct bearing on the goal of life, the highest fulfillment of man on earth. The difficulty is that of discovering the divine will. For men have so many ideas, values in life by which men seek to govern partially through his conduct, partially though by which they want to govern their conduct. Gita is Catholic in its scope and accepts all lesser ideals and values as preliminary preparatory stages, as steps on the way to the discovery of the divine will. But it insists again and again upon necessity of making the discovery. You must not simply rest satisfied with what you are doing, but insist on making the discovery of an impersonal, cosmic and divine will. Though in a certain sense everything happens by the sanction of the divine will, still there is for man the personal, individual, collective aspect of the divine will, discoverable, and this is the problem set before Arjuna in the Gita. When we equate the divine will to a principle, to an idea, to an ideal, to a value, which one follows, but over and above and independent of all such intermediate permissible standards, there is a divine will which is to be discovered. The divine purpose is at work in the universe, in the individual's life and in that of the collectivity. This is the basis of the Gita, you see. This is on which then Gita is founded. We'll come to some portion of the Gita, but this is taking out how, you know, they look at the Gita from which point of view and how to judge the teachings of the Gita, because if you otherwise get into the detail of the interpretation, then the background will be not very clear, you see. Gita points out psychological processes and methods by which one can gradually progress towards the discovery of the divine will. It can be arranged in a form of a graded rise with methodical steps. One has to begin by doing action without desire for the result, with an attitude of equality, samatha, in which neither good nor adverse result affects the inner balance and the fundamental attitude of detachment. In fact, the establishment of samatha or equality in the consciousness under all conditions is a sign that one has succeeded in giving up the desire or attachment for the fruit of his actions. That would be the sign. Gita suggests a further step. On the basis of Sankhya realization, it speaks of the two parts of the human consciousness. This we have dealt with in our yoga lectures, you see, when we made the exposition between Purusha and Prakriti differentiation, you see. Gita puts this two parts of the human consciousness, a realizable dichotomy of the inner being of man. There is in each individual a part that can separate itself from the nature aspect, the active part, the part that changes, from the mind and all its ideas, suggestions and movements, from his emotions, feelings and their actions and reactions, from his desires, impulses and passions of the vital, and from the body. And this part can remain unaffected by all the activities of this nature. It is the Purusha as a Sakshi, the witness consciousness. Gita says that by practicing this separation of Purusha and Prakriti, this separate self and the moving nature, man would be able to control his nature more effectively, and it would serve as the initial step in the process of transformation of nature. This is the one practical remedy suggests, side by side with the advice to give up all desire for the result of one's action. People very often question, how can one act when he has given up all desire for the result of his action? Gita suggests a step that if one wants to practice desireless action, action should be done as a sacrifice to the divine, as an offering to the divine. Not for any result or not for any fruit of the action, but as an offering to the divine, as a sacrifice, you see? Gita points out the distinction between tyaga and sannyas for the first time. Renunciation, you see, external and true renunciation. It says that if you put on an ochre color garb and go about like sannyasi, it's not true renunciation. Gita, that way, is very revolutionary, very unorthodox, you see. Gita doesn't say that if you put on a sannyasi's garb, you are a man who is renounced, because renunciation is inner, according to Gita. External and true renunciation. There was an excessive otherworldly stress in the spiritual ideals of Gita for centuries, though renunciation of life as an indispensable condition for spiritual realization was not accepted by the Vedic sages, nor was it accepted by the Upanishads. The conception of the divine in the Gita is not that of a static being. The conception of divine in the Gita is dynamic. Active aspect of the divine also is accepted and given a greater prominence than any book in India. Gita may be said to be unique in emphasizing this aspect and related to life. Not only God is active, but it is actively related to life. This omnipresent reality, the divine, has a purpose, a divine purpose, and life is meant to be the field for the working out of that purpose. And even the battlefield of Kurukshetra is not exempted from it. That is what Gita's teaching comes to. That divine purpose can extend its, you know, its field of operation not merely to normal, innocent activities, but to critical and cruel activities like the battlefield, fighting. Even there the purpose of the divine can be, can find its field. Yes. Even the battlefield of Kurukshetra is not exempted from it. By implication, and even by open declaration, Gita says that life is not altogether governed by the ego, either individual ego or collective ego. Sri Aurobindo suggests that Kurukshetra can be taken to be a symbol of the battle of life. As Arjuna was on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, but every soul can consider his life as the battlefield of Kurukshetra, and Kurukshetra can become symbolic, because in his life also there will be always such conflicts between ideals, values, between duties, various kinds of duties, whether it is good to, submit to what is required by outer standards, or whether one has to follow some inner light. In the inner light there is conflict between mind and vital being, which to follow, and so on. There will always be conflict in life. So he says it is perhaps good to take the Kurukshetra as a symbol, and in fact he suggests Kurukshetra can be taken as a symbol of the battle of life, in which forces of light and forces of darkness are constantly clashing. As regards the dilemma of Arjuna, Sri Krishna assures him that the divine will shall be fulfilled as far as the battle of Kurukshetra is concerned, even if Arjuna would not participate in it as an instrument. This is a very strong position of the Gita, and one very rarely taken up by any other book and scripture. Arjuna refuses to be convinced of the necessity of fighting. Arjuna is struck by remorse, and he thinks that he will be committing a great sin if he killed his own cousins and so on. So after a good deal of argumentation, he does not submit to Krishna's persuasion. So Krishna says, all right, even if you don't fight, I am going to carry out my purpose in the battle of Kurukshetra. I would like very much that you should be my instrument in carrying out my will through. But even if you don't, well, what I have intended will have to happen. So far is the stress on the divine will carrying its own, in difficult situation in individual and collective life. Divine will be fulfilled as far as the battle of Kurukshetra is concerned, even if Arjuna would not participate in it as the instrument. He says to Arjuna, in fact, Kurukshetra is not your battle only. The words he uses are that it is not only your interests are at stake, but my purpose also is at stake. Though each participant has joined this battlefield for his own purpose on his own calculation. Each warrior that came or leader that came there to participate, on his own calculation. Either because somebody's brother was there, somebody's matronkle was there, somebody's influence was there, some leader was there, and he had to submit to the pressure and came on his own calculation. But Sri Krishna says that each one fighting here has his own. I have my own purpose, which overrides all the purposes of the individuals that are fighting here. It is mine, and I have a purpose to carry out, and it would be carried out at any cost. We might note that the Gita teaches that collective life has also a divine purpose to fulfill. The world we live in wears the appearance of an inert, inconscient creation, and human life is full of the play of ignorant forces and which are on the mind. Many religious and philosophical systems have given great prominence, including Buddhism, for instance, to this aspect. To Gita, the world is not altogether undivine. It devotes 4 chapters to the Vibhuti Yoga to show how the world is magnificent, beautiful and divine. This is Gita's wonderful contribution, you see. In the previous synthesis in the Isha Upanishad, the Upanishad begins with this declaration, Isha Vasya Vidam Sarvam. We repeated that on the first day when we opened the session, you see. All this is for imitation by the Lord. These 4 chapters of the Gita are practically a commentary on this. All this is for habitation by the Lord. How? And Gita's 4 chapters, beginning with the 7th, 8th, 9th and 10th, I think, you see, they are a sort of application of this view that life is divine. Now, all along we are told in many philosophical systems that life is anything but divine. It is undivine and sinful and conflict and struggle and unworthy and so on. Gita is the first book in that respect, a scripture, when Arjuna says, well, how can I know? You say that you lived here before, you practiced yoga before, and that you know all your past births and so on, you know my birth also. How to know that you are here, and that how to know that God is here? Oh, he says, that I will tell you. And then he begins the 4 chapters, and in which he says, look, you want to see me? All right, I will show you. And then he says, look at the Himalayas if you want to see me in matter. Look at the Ganges if you want to see me as a river. Look at the banyan tree if you want to see me as a tree. Like that, there is a list given, you see, showing that world is not all undivine. There are, you know, aspects of the divine in each plane of consciousness, manifesting a magnificence and a greatness and you can call it in one sense, sublimity of the divine is present on each plane, and you can feel it. So he says, don't try to look at the world as if it was all undivine and made up only of ignorant and horrible things and so on. You look at it, I am also present there. In Vibhuti is a particular manifestation of the divine. Vibhuti is not incarnation. Vibhuti is not avatar. You see, the Gita, Indian culture, makes distinction between the partial aspects of the divine manifested in one quality or one power and an incarnation coming with directly with the divine consciousness. For instance, if you take a quality of mercy or quality of non-violence, now that quality, if it is raised to its level and brought down into life, then the man who embodies it will be a vibhuti of ahimsa, vibhuti of non-violence, you see. Vibhuti is the embodiment in human life of a prominent trait or power of the divine, a property or quality of the divine, more than human in its dimensions. When it is manifested, well, it is a vibhuti, you see. Normally a man may be generous, but if a man can be generous to the extent where he feels this is superhuman generosity, then that would be vibhuti of generosity, you see, vibhuti of generousness. So man might be non-violent ordinarily, but when he expresses or brings into his life an extraordinary degree of non-violence like Gandhi, then you say he is a vibhuti of the ahimsa, vibhuti of non-violence, is divine aspect of non-violence, you see. The quality, when it is human and extraordinary, you say it is a great human attribute. But when it passes over the limit of ordinary humanity, then it becomes a divine quality. You see, quality of the divine. So that when a man manifests that, he is called Vibhuti. And when he manifests the supreme consciousness of the divine himself, then he is called Avatar, the descent, the incarnation. Incarnation is conscious of his divinity. The Vibhuti is conscious of the quality, power, aspect of the divinity which he manifests. You see? Well, there, Krishna points out in 4 chapters the aspect of the world in which the divine can be seen in his magnificence in matter, in life, in vegetable kingdom, in animal kingdom, in all aspects of human life, insisting that you must not look only on one side, you see, and always think that the world is unconscious, inert, made of matter, without consciousness, absence of divine and so on. Says that I am present. Now this aspect is not brought out in the Upanishads, for instance. The avatarvad, the incarnation aspect, is not in the Upanishads. It doesn't find a place in the Upanishads. So many elements like that the Gita brings forward. Yes, where is it? Even matter, which is regarded as inert and can and it points out can be sublime, the Himalayas are the divine in matter. In fact, these 4 chapters of the Gita may be regarded as a detailed exegesis of the opening verse of each Upanishad, Isa Vasya Midam Saram Yaskinti Jagat Kyam Jagat. All this is for habitation by the Lord. Huh? Well, that is Sanskrit. whatever is moving in the universal movement. See, Krishna points out in effect that the divine is not absent from the world, that he is here flowing in the rivers and in the vegetable kingdom also. Gita makes us feel the divine presence in the world, for the world is not merely what our senses represent it to be. The divine is there even though unperceived by man. One of the basic ideas of the Vedanta derived from the Sankhya system is that Purusha, the self, is eternally free, and Prakriti, the nature, is condemned to remain bound. This is a Vedantic position which even Shankar has accepted, you see. It is eternally ignorant and imperfect and will always remain so. Nature will be what it is. As I told you, Vivekananda pulling the dog's tail, and if you leave it, it will again, you see, go back to the original position. Now, Gita points out that as Purusha is eternally free, so Prakriti also can be claimant to freedom. Gita, for the first time, puts it categorically and clearly that if the subjective aspect is free, the nature also can be free. Before Gita, the philosophers and the religious leaders did not grant freedom to nature. They say nature will be bound, will be always ignorant. Purusha can be free, subjective self, but that in which he will manifest or express himself will be always imperfect. Well, only freedom, but even perfection. This can be seen by studying the implications of some of the aspects of the Gita. Even though the essential divinity is the same in the saint and in the sinner, now, fundamental divinity is not changed. Because a man is sinner, the divine in him does not become a sinner. You see, in a sinner, the divine is present, is divine. Divine is not sinner. Fundamentally, though the divinity is the same as in the saint and the sinner, still the saint has to be protected and saved, says the Gita. You see, paritranaya sadhunam vinashaya duskrutam, that is the verse of the Gita, that I take birth in order to, you know, punish the wicked or destroy the evildoer and protect the sadhus, protect the saints, or people with goodwill and you know, people who embody higher values of life. I have to take birth in order to protect them and also to destroy those who are evildoers. Now there, you see, Gita admits unity of soul and yet admits a distinction in nature part, because the man is a saint or a sinner not in his essential self but in his nature. A man becomes a sinner not in his inner self, which is divine in all, even in the sinner. In spite of him, the divinity is there. And still Gita says that the saint has to be protected and the sinner has to be punished. Now you see that there the distinction is pointed out, and this distinction is in nature part. The Mahatma, or the great soul, the Shrestha, the leader, and the ordinary man, the distinction is due to that which expresses itself in their nature. Essentially they are all divine. And yet one is put here, another is put here, third is put here. Because how much of the divinity comes out in their nature? You understand? So the distinction is made by what expresses itself in the nature part. Next, the Gita speaks of the vibhuti, the special becoming of the divine. The vibhuti embodies not merely the nature of a sadhu or a mahatma or a great soul, not a heightened human perfection, but some quality, some aspect of the divine and his power. That may be regarded as a second step in the nature's ascent to freedom and perfection. In the vibhuti, nature rises to a far greater height than even the highest attainment reached by man. For example,